We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies.
Seth, thank you so much for being on Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. Would you first just tell us what you're working on at Honor? I know you've been working on it for a bit, but for anyone who doesn't know.
Yeah. So at Honor, we help older adults remain in their homes as they age. And the way we do that is we send a care professional into the home of an older adult, and they help that person with what are called ADLs, or activities of daily living. So that's like get out of bed, get food, get dressed. It can be bathing. It's like anything where if you can't do like two of those things, you can no longer live in your own home. And so you get someone to help you out so you can stay at home.
I love the simplicity. I'm curious to learn if it's always been that simple, if you always had that same mission.
Yeah. So, yes, but the mission is actually a little broader than that. So I built a company with some other co-founders, and we'd sold that one. And the next company that we worked on, we wanted to be look a human in the eye and know we'd make their lives fundamentally better. But then we wanted to be millions of humans, not just one. And then we wanted a hard societal problem, because we felt like as multi-time founders, we could kind of go for something that was really difficult to accomplish, right? And then if we could win, then it would be a big win for society. So what we actually think about is, hey, how do we change the way society cares for our older adults? Like, we have this big problem where the world's aging very quickly. We are not very good at taking care of older adults. And we see home care as kind of the first place on the, travel or, voyage, if you will, in order to achieve that ultimate goal.
That's really cool. I appreciate you kind of helping with that, because there's so many times where I hear just pivot stories as well, but taking it to like the personal piece, because I think when I first started this podcast, it was only just about the business, but I think there's such an interesting piece of like knowing where did you grow up? Maybe what made you first get excited about starting companies? I'd love to hear that story.
Yeah. So I grew up in Connecticut. And why did I get excited about starting companies? I guess I started my first company maybe largely because I was scared to work for anybody else. I feel like that probably had a lot to do with it. And then, you have a product that you come up with that you want to exist, and you find people to help you build it. And these days, probably the only thing I think about is how do you like build more things that will help society in some way or another. Because I think that's a good, way to spend your time. But yeah, I grew up in Connecticut, and I came up with this idea because I ran into an issue with my mother. So entrepreneurs, you probably hear this all the time, they tend to solve their own problems. And since I'd already built one company, and so therefore I was older, I didn't have this much gray hair, but I've gotten it on the path of doing Honor. Since I was a little bit older, I'd already done one company. My parents were no longer my solution, but rather they were now a thing that I was thinking about how to solve for. Right. So that's how the idea of helping older adults came to be.
That's so cool. And so those are just, they seem like the best companies, because you're like, hey, like I'm just being real. I'm authentically trying to solve a real need that I've felt.
Yeah. I think those are the best ones. And what I say to entrepreneurs frequently is, it's going to be hard. It's probably going to be 7 years. And so to get yourself through those hard points, you've got to really care, right? Because it's so easy to give up. Again, there's so many opportunities to give up, and you've got to have that reason why you're going to keep fighting. So you have to really, really care about the problem that you're trying to solve.
So good. Tell me about how you got to Silicon Valley, like the decision to move and why.
Yeah. So like I said, I grew up in Connecticut, and I guess I was lucky. One of my best friends moved to California for college, and I visited him. And when I'd visit him, this was, we were class in college, we were class of 01. So, right, we were graduating when the world was falling apart and, a massive economic down cycle, first bubble pop, blah, blah, blah. But, I visited him in 1998 and 1999 too. And I'm watching all these companies get created, and it just feels like so energetic and so much is happening. And I knew that if I wanted to start companies, like growing up in Connecticut, it was kind of like somewhat a culture of you can't, or here's why it'll fail. And that always really actually chafed at me. Like I'd have these ideas all the time, And everyone would tell me why they'd fail. And when I was in California and the people I was hanging out with there, it was more like, hey, here's the reason why it could succeed, or here's what you could do to make it better. And so I really wanted to get out there because I could just tell that it had the ecosystem to help me start building companies.
That's like I moved from the East Coast as well, and I started had a startup there. And it is just a different, like, people just don't understand it as much. It just seems like kind of pie in the sky stuff that we're doing over here. Whereas here, it's like the whole ecosystem is set up, ready to help you run. Yeah,
I think that is the difference. So like in the East Coast, you can do startups, right? And now more than ever, you can do it. Because remember, I'm talking about the East Coast 20 years ago. But, you know, more than ever, you can do startups anywhere. But there is something about the percentage of people who you surround yourself with who are kind of familiar with and helpful with what you're trying to accomplish. And the thing you have to remember when you're doing a startup is it's really just like, can you keep knocking down the next barrier? It's like, it's, you know, can you get a team together? Can you find an office? Can you get insurance in place? Can you find a lawyer? It's like all these can you do's. And it's just like a, you know, it's a task list. And some of those things are hard. Some of them are easy. But the more people you have around you to kind of ask, like, hey, how do you do this? Or how would you approach this? And to get like, yeah, you can. And here's how. That's helpful.
Get in the playbook. Here's how we did it. Boom, boom, boom. I love that. Help me with a low moment that you had in the journey that you'd be comfortable sharing. Because a lot of founders just see the TechCrunch article and they get discouraged. But I know there's a lot more that's been happening.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, one of our low points was COVID breaks out. And in our business, you know, we're literally sending people, care professionals, into the homes of older adults to help them. And as COVID was breaking out and we're starting to understand what COVID is, we're like, oh my God, we're sending people into the homes of older adults who could infect them. And that could be really dangerous. And that was a big low moment. We're like, can we possibly survive this? Like, should we keep operating this, et cetera? And what we did is, it's like anything, it's just another barrier that you have to decide if you're going to push through or not. So the way we push through it is we created all of these kind of infection control protocols where we got really strict about monitoring. Did our care professionals have symptoms? You know, were they reporting anything? We even put other things like, you know, sick leave for the entire country, even where it wasn't legally required, in place, because we wanted the care pros to not have any kind of incentive to not tell us, right? We wanted them to tell us if they were not feeling well, and don't worry, you will still be paid, right? So like we created policies that on the surface looked like they cost us a lot of money, but they kept our employees and they kept our clients safe. So, you know, you just have to recognize you're always going to hit like brick walls. They suck. And you just got to be creative, right? And find a way to bust through them or climb over them or dig under them or something.
Some way around it. That's amazing. Could you take us into maybe a board conversation? Because I imagine that there might have been some pushback on even that strategy, or even just into your head, or before you got to that strategy when you realized like the brick wall is there.
Board meetings in that time, I mean, every board was, you know, looking at their portfolio and kind of looking at this kind of disaster or that kind of disaster. So there was nothing abnormal about, hey, we've got this big problem because of COVID and we don't know how to deal with it, right? Other companies had other problems, but very few were like problem free. One of the things that I think is kind of like a hallmark of great boards is they do not try to run the company, and they know they shouldn't run the company because they don't have the day-to-day like data. They're not there. They understand that they've invested in a certain management team, and they can choose to change the management team, right? But they don't run the company. And so I doubt we even brought that one to the board. Like, it doesn't rise to the level where we'd feel like, oh, we have to talk to the board about this. Like, that's just a decision we're making, you know, as the people running the company.
Wow. That's really good. It sounds like you got great people around you. Who trust you.
Yes. And that's, you know, like I kind of was saying up front, that's one of the key parts of the game, right? Is how do you surround? And it's kind of a key part of the game of life. You often take on the traits, positive and negative, of the people around you. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you surround yourself, you know, typically I try to surround myself basically with people who are smarter than I am. Like, I literally feel like most of the people I hang out with are smarter than I am. And then if you hang out with people who have really like diverse experiences and perspectives, that makes you much stronger. And, you know, a thing that you have to remember and I felt this acutely, like you walk into a high school or a college and you look at who kids are sitting with, and like almost just visually, each lunch table looks like that table, right? Like all the kids at that table look like all the other kids at that table. It's like, it's kind of sad. And you have to push, if you want to, I think, if you want to be an effective entrepreneur, you have to push out of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because you just can't understand everything about how to do everything. You need to hang out with people who are not like you. Mm. And you want those people to be smart, right? And you want those people to pull you up and make you more capable.
Mm. That's really good advice. And yeah, it's so easy to have that echo chamber piece as well. But yeah,
kind of
that's
human default. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's really good. Well, the rest of the conversation, I'd love to prioritize talking about the moment that you hit product market fit and then the steps before that, not to replicate, but just to inspire a similar strategy for founders who haven't done it yet. So if you could, I know this is tough, but like with Sammy, I did this with Trulio, like just like even getting a month where you were like, or that first moment where you're like, this, we've hit this, there's something here.
Yeah. So I hate to do this to you, but I would actually posit to you that that's too simple a heuristic. And there's actually this scale that you have to look at startups on. And one spectrum that you can kind of plot almost every startup on is it taking execution risk or is it taking market risk? And if it's taking market risk, your question's valid, right? Like, hey, I don't know if people want this thing. I'm going to keep iterating until I find a thing that they want. And at some point I hit what people call product market fit, right? Like, oh, I'm selling a thing people want. There is a different kind of risk, which is execution risk. It's like, hey, if I build this, I know everybody's going to want it, but wow, is it really, really hard to build, right? So that's execution risk. And what I would argue is that in like you want to do a startup that has either market risk but very little execution risk, or execution risk with very little market risk, because you want to know the reason you're failing, right? You want to know the reason why it's not working, and you don't want to have to kind of debate with yourself, do people want this or not? And did I do a good job of building or not? You kind of want to know. So startups that are kind of equally in the middle between those two, I would say probably don't do them. And so Honor was very much an execution risk company. Like we already knew there's a $30 billion industry. We already knew it was hyper fragmented. We already knew the experience for care pros and clients was totally broken. So we didn't know why per se it didn't scale well. We didn't know why it was so hyper fragmented. So that was an execution risk problem. But we knew, hey, if you can build good home care that's like better than what people currently buy to the tune of $30 billion, then you will be in a good spot. So sorry, threw you a curveball on your PMF question.
No, this is why I asked that question. And it's amazing. It's way more insightful what you're saying. And I completely hear that. It's almost like a cancer drug. Will people buy that? We know that.
All execution risk, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. And you're saying you're a little bit off of the cancer example in that one.
Yeah, we're not quite the cancer example, but you're really, really close to that, right? Because if you, you know, one of the models you can take as an entrepreneur is just say, look, there's this thing people already do, but like, and they need it. You know, in our case, we're like, wow, people are spending $30 billion in home care, but it sucks, right? Like it really needs a reboot. That's amazing. Imagine how big the market would be if you built really amazing home care. Right. And so that's the way we looked at it. There was no PMF, do people want it question. There was just, can we actually do it had not historically been done.
That is really cool. So in that kind of execution risk priority, like company, I imagine that you're competing with a lot with larger incumbents who have a lot more money than you more frequently.
So in our case, it was a little bit different because what we were competing with is 20,000 kind of mom and pops. Now, half of them had kind of joined franchise networks and half of them were kind of technically independent, but they all really were just like independent. So what you're competing with actually in this case is kind of this market force, right? It's okay, I'm going to hang a shingle in the SF Bay Area. You're competing with 200 other agencies, like literally 200 other agencies. And really the competition is like, why is it 200 other agencies? Why are none of them, you know, bigger than in a, you know, roughly $300 million market in the SF Bay Area? why is it that none of them have gotten bigger than like, you know, $5 or $6 million? Like, you know, what is the thing that's holding people back? So, you know, oftentimes people worry about, so people always like fixate on like the competitive company. And I think what people should fixate on is that it is a startup, and I definitely am not the one who coined this, but I'm going to remind everybody, startups do not die by homicide. They die by suicide. Like, that's how startups die. You didn't make it. You didn't succeed. And in our case, it was very clear, right? Like, the market was really hard. Something about it was really hard to scale in, and it would be on us. It wouldn't be that one of those other little agencies killed us. It would be that we didn't figure out how to address the market dynamic. And what that does, by the way, is kind of empowering, right? Because you don't get to outsource your failure on something else. It is on you to succeed or fail.
This is interesting. I want to dive into how you analyze this, because I know you authentically had the problem. So it wasn't like you were just like, I'm going to pick the best possible thing to build. You wanted to do something in this. But what was different about this, and how did you look at it?
Yeah. So it's a great question. What we saw very clearly is the needs of my mom and your mom are probably different. The wants of one care pro versus another care pro are also probably different. Different schedules, different skills. They live in different places, et cetera. They like different kinds of people to work for. So it's a two-sided heterogeneous marketplace. Right? Because both sides are heterogeneous. Like, your mom and my mom are different. That care pro and that care pro are different. And so what you can say is that almost certainly with more market liquidity on both sides, you will have better matches, right? Because that heterogeneity means you benefit from a lot of supply and a lot of demand. And yet it had never happened. And so we had a going in theory on the reason why it had never happened, but we knew we couldn't be sure, right? We only had research, and research is not as good as actually like seeing it and doing it, you know, touch feel. So what we did is we built some thin veneer technology that kind of made our initial home care company that we launched in the SF Bay Area kind of look modern. But under the surface, it was run by humans, right? We didn't try to fix these like difficult logistical challenges, because we just had to see like, why the heck did this thing not work, right? And so the way we approached trying to validate, like, what is it that has kept this thing that should consolidate from consolidating, we just needed to experience those problems ourselves. And let me tell you, we grew quickly. We experienced those problems big time. They were really, really painful. It was like, okay, we now see exactly why this thing never scales. We almost shut down. Like, there was this point where we hit about $10 million in revenue. And I literally was saying to myself, this is not a technology tractable problem. Like, I just don't see how this can possibly be solved in technology. It's so, so impossible. And humans are so heterogeneous. But it turned out that at that scale, we had just enough data to start kind of running some real ML against the problems, and we're able to figure it out.
Wow. What a story. This is, it's so unique, but so you basically just built like a mom and pop on steroids in the beginning as an experiment.
Yep.
With the scalable mindset, and you were able to raise money on that. Did you have any investors who were like, hey, how do we know we're not just going to be investing in a lifestyle company that stays like this forever?
So, you know, fortunately, since I had built a previous company that had gotten pretty large, it was a little bit easier for us to raise money. This is why I actually said we wanted a hard problem. Because one of the things about being a second-time entrepreneur, if you've had kind of a first successful company, is it is you both can raise money easier. But let's throw that one out. Like, that's important for what I'm about to say. But what's really important is that you already have the basics down. Like, you know how to build a team, you know how to incorporate, you know which lawyers to use. Like, a lot of the blocking and tackling that you have to learn your first time around, you just know. And so you can focus on a harder problem as a second time entrepreneur, because a lot of the like rote stuff you already know how to do. And that lets you put more of your brain cycles into, hey, but this is a really, really challenging problem. How could I unlock it?
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You want to move closer essentially to the execution risk side.
Closer to execution risk. As a second time, that's exactly right. As a second time entrepreneur, you are incented to be more on the execution risk side than on the market risk side. Because market risk, who knows? It doesn't matter if you're first or second time entrepreneur, you just don't know until you try. But execution risk, you are disproportionately likely to be able to solve an execution risk thing as a second time entrepreneur.
That's so good.
You know, one thing, sorry, would just say, and I feel this really strongly, is a bunch of my friends are second time entrepreneurs and have done exactly this. They have launched companies that are healthcare or some other kind of like hard problem that's, you know, aimed squarely at societal good. And I really, really respect that. And I wish, like, I kind of wish, honestly, all entrepreneurs would focus on that, like, especially second timers. It's like, hey, if you have the capability for whatever reason, you're a second timer or some other capability that you have as an entrepreneur, you're a first timer, solve societal problems that matter, right? Like something that's really going to help move the world forward in the right way, because like we need it.
That's so good. And you know, the death rate's 100%. So there's only so much time.
Yep.
I really appreciate that. The next question, I wanted to just double tap on like, what were some of the problems that you saw when you were at that 10 million state that like overwhelmed you to the point where like, we might need to shut down
and
this might not be solvable?
So like one example would be, you know, you'd have a client, Mrs. Smith, and she would love this care professional, Janet. But then your other client, Mrs. Jones, hated Janet, the care pro. And so it's like, well, is Janet good or bad? And the answer is she's good for some people and bad for other people, right? And that shouldn't be surprising because that's the way humans work. But then you'd have these other sets, one kind of problem. Another kind of problem would be, you know, you'd talk to Janet and you'd say, hey, Janet, when can you work? You know, one example, what days do you not want to work? And Janet says, well, Saturdays, I just don't want to work. And so then you show Janet like three clients that Janet could choose from, same day. Three clients, here they are, here are their schedules. Which one would you like to work for? And Janet picks a client that has, you know, care on Saturdays. And you're like, but Janet, you just told me that you don't want to work on Saturdays. And Janet's like, oh, well, that's different because blah, blah, blah. And you're just like, oh my God. You know, so you can't figure out who's a good and bad care pro. You can't figure out how to ask care pros, you know, even when they want to work. So we're talking about like a totally what seemingly impossible problem, right? Like you can't get these most basic things down. Like, can I figure out if this is a good or bad care pro? Can I figure out when this care pro wants to work? And in retrospect, when you start putting ML against it, you can actually make it work. Every one thing you have to remember is products and industries tend to happen when society is ready and when technology platforms are ready. Like those two things have to converge for a new product category to emerge, like social networks or, you know, car share or whatever. One of the things that had to emerge for home care was AI, because there is no one right answer. There's no static algorithm on who's a good care pro. And the answer is it depends based on people and heterogeneity. So AI is good at that, right? Not. I'm not talking about Gen AI. We use that in other ways. I'm talking about kind of ML, you know, statistical regressions AI. It can be very good at that, right? And that was necessary to unlock kind of scaling home care.
Mm. Did you know that going in, like when you were evaluating this in the research phase?
Definitely not. No. We knew logistics was the reason why. Or we were pretty sure logistics was the reason why home care agencies could not scale. They got to the what's called the Dunbar number. So in someone's head, they were running a group of 150 people. It's like 30 clients, 40 care pros, 40 sons and daughters, and some office staff. It was 150 people, and that's as big as they could ever get because the owner was kind of solving it in their head. But we didn't know until we got there that, you know, if you could actually use at what at the time was kind of this novel AI thing where you could say, hey, I'm not going to have a static definition of what a good care pro is, but I'm going to be flexible about that based on who the care pro is and who what the client's needs are.
Mm. What an amazing, so in your research, like going back before you actually like launched the company that became a $10 million SMB essentially, what did you, how did that fall short? Because I imagine that you interviewed some owners of these organizations already.
Yeah, so we talked to owners. We talked to a lot of care pros, actually. We went to Phoenix, interviewed 20 of them, 25 of them. Sacramento, interviewed 25 of them. We didn't do it in the Bay Area because the Bay Area is too weird, right? Like, you just, we felt like the market day wouldn't be good.
Wow.
And we interviewed, you know, agency owners as well, obviously. And, you know, one thing you have to just remember when you're doing initial research, users tell you what they think they want. They definitely don't know how to build it, right? And the most helpful people that we talked to were actually the care professionals. And one of the things they, you know, this really poignant one interview in Phoenix at Starbucks, that care professional said, look, like, I am a professional. I want to be treated like a professional, but I'm treated like dirt.
Wow.
And it was actually in the flight home that we said, you know what? We're going to actually call these people care pros, care professionals. Mm. That's what we came up for, with the word. So they said, like, in the very basic sense, we're going to call care pros what they want to be, not caregivers, but care pros, care professionals. So, you know, no agency owner. The other challenge in this complexity is agency owners usually will say, hey, the thing that keeps me from scaling is I can't find enough care pros, right? They're like caregivers, but like, and the problem with that, of course, is if you say to them, well, what percentage of your market do you have? They'll say some really low number, like 1 or 2%. And you'll say, okay, so for like every 2 care pros you employ, someone else is employing 98 care pros. So it's not that they don't exist, right? Like it's that somehow something in the way you're running your agency is not enabling you to be able to either find them or scale to finding them or, you know, match them with customers. You're experiencing it as I can't find care pros. But it's actually a logistics problem because you don't have your full market.
Mm. This is amazing. I have thoroughly enjoyed this. And so thank you for just like going under the hood here. I'm the next phase that I'm just curious about is like, how do you approach customer experience? And yeah, you know, everyone knows this is a Zendesk podcast. I usually don't directly ask these, but I think because of what you're working on, it must have been so essential to be able to have that quality experience that you don't fully control.
Yep. So the first thing that we started with is what we call, we started calling care for the care pro. And the idea was if we created better jobs and a better life for the care pros, that they would end up providing better care to our customers. And we really stayed with that for a really long time. Like we kind of like, you know, squeezed that, you know, orange or whatever as much as we could to get all the juice out of it. And the reason is that we really deeply believed in it and it got us a lot of gains around client experience. It's just creating a more stable, better job for care pros where we truly treated them like a professional. What we then moved on to is kind of this defect framework that we use today where we would say, hey, what are the defects that clients really care about as represented in statistics? Like, but based on client behavior, we can see this thing really bothers clients en masse. And then we can kind of rank them and we can look at how they interact with each other. And then once we know what those things are, we can then change the way the system works to try to address those problems. And so that's kind of our latest state of the art that's more client focused because we have built this really solid foundation on the care for the care pro, right? So like first part was care for the care pro, build a really solid foundation there, then switch over to a client view and look at basically a defects framework.
Wow. That is, so what was the client view? If you could tell me more about that one. I love hearing like prioritizing the employee. The customer is not always right in a lot of examples. So I love that.
Yeah, actually, oddly, that was sometimes quite true in care for the care pro, right? Especially if you have clients who have dementia, for example, and they might say, hey, this care pro stole something, but you know, that care pro has a stellar record otherwise. And you can say, hey, or they'd often say, hey, the care pro was late or whatnot. And we use GPS tracking. And we could say, you know what, the care pro actually literally was there at this time. Like we know it's GPS verified. So we early on, we found a lot of cases where we really had to care for the care pro and that had to be the base. On the client side, one of the top things that's super interesting that we found is clients really care about what we call consistency. And consistency is they want to see the same care pro again and again. They want to form a relationship with that person. So our systems like seek very much to create these really stable relationships between care pros and clients. And it turns out that the care pros really like that too.
Wow. Yeah, and that's a human tendency that we could like quarterback and look behind and say, oh, that makes sense. But I wonder, like, it just seems like that shouldn't be insightful, but I imagine how it's interesting that it was.
I mean, a lot of stuff, I think, the problem is I could throw like five things at you that sound right, right? Like clients like a reliable care pro, clients like the same care pro, clients like a care pro who cooks the kind of food they're used to eating. Like I could throw a bunch of stuff at you. The problem is that we'd have no way to know which ones actually matter, right? If we're just bantering about it. And so when you get powerful is when you look to the data and you can find the patterns in the data that tell you, hey, what a client really cares about is blah, or these three things, and here's even how they interact, et cetera. And I even can know how much better I'll grow if I fix this thing because I've statistically analyzed like its impact on experience. Like that's when you get powerful, right? When you know, you stop the debate and you know what things clients truly care about.
Mm. Prioritizing.
Another way of saying everything in retrospect, of course, seems obvious, but before you have the data, you'd be debating whether or not it's the one.
Mm. That is so good. Well, just a final question, like what would you tell yourself before you started Honor? If you could go back and give yourself like one big piece of advice that you've learned.
It'll be even harder than you think. Probably that. Don't worry about it. You'll get through it, but it'll be harder than you think.
Wow. Even in those low moments, which I know you had, and this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Seth, for taking the time. And I can just tell you have like a scientific approach to this that is really, really interesting.
Yep. It's been fun. Yeah. It's great to chat. Thank you so much for having me on, Adam. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guess the target, or anything else so we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.